and he had scars that now are still were still evident, and lawyers for the RCMP and the Human Rights Commission approached him there and looked at the scars on his head and on his hands and grew into these scars that he still carries with him today. I found that extremely powerful. He has to live with that reminder, right? Whenever he combs or washes his hair and he feels his scalp, the bumps on there, and when he looks at his hands every day.
Hello and welcome to CICK News. CICK News is your local and regional news coverage provided by me, Pamela Hassan, and Dan Messick for Smithers Community Radio. This news program is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada, and our aim is to provide local coverage on stories that affect the lives of Northerners like you. This is CICK News for May 11th, 2023. Today, I'm pretty thrilled to be speaking with Kathleen Martins, a journalist for APTN, about the ongoing human rights hearing happening at the Gathering Place in Burns Lake as we speak. The case was brought to the Human Rights Commission in 2017 by six members of the Babine Lake Nation when the RCMP found their previous case against a teacher at a day school in Burns Lake in the 1960s and 70s to be dismissed of all charges. In my interview with Kathleen, you'll hear what some of those original charges were. The human rights hearing happening now consists of 24 complainant witnesses and 10 defendants' witnesses. The case is slated to take 10 weeks in total, with these first 2 weeks live at the Gathering Place for ease of some of the elderly witnesses of the Babine Lake Nation. Whether or not the next 8 weeks will be available to watch live for media is yet to be determined, as this case thus far has been under some discretion due to a publication ban against the original accused, who Kathleen and I will be referring to as AB, but also some of the witnesses' names will be exempted from public disclosure because there is a real and substantial risk that the disclosure of personal matters will cause undue hardship to the persons involved, which outweighs the societal interest in this inquiry being conducted in public, according to the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal statement of particulars. When the verdict of this case was presented as a mishandling by the RCMP and brought forth to the Human Rights Commission in 2017, the case became about a history of mistrust against Indigenous peoples in Canada, as well as more suffering against residential and day school survivors who have bravely come forward to tell their stories for themselves, their loved ones, and their people. Warning, this episode does include some depictions of violence around the 8-minute mark, so please listen with caution.
I'm Kathleen Martins. I'm the senior digital reporter at aptnnews.ca. That's the online brother or sister to our national TV newscast every night.
And how long have you been working at APTN, not just in this position?
12 and a half years.
Okay, so we were both present on May 2nd. You were there longer, but we were both present on May 2nd at the Gathering Place in Burns Lake to cover the human rights hearing. Can you tell me what witnesses you were present for last week?
Yes, I heard Dorothy Williams. She was up first, then Richard Perry. So I missed Morris Joseph. So I heard Dorothy Williams, Richard Perry, Laura Robinson. Those are the three. And another witness was on Friday, but her name is protected under a confidentiality order. There's 10 witnesses' names are protected under a 2021 confidentiality order. So we can name the ones we heard last week, which would be Morris Joseph, Dorothy Williams, Richard Perry, Laura Robinson, but after that, they're all protected.
And where are some of the witnesses protected?
So what happened was in 2021, APTN applied to the commission to live stream the hearings. And it set off, a bunch of stuff. We had made new law, like APTN bought to bring TV cameras into the tribunal in Ottawa when it was hearing the discrimination case that Cindy Blackstock brought against the federal government when it came to funding off-reserve children in the child welfare system. And we argued that that was huge public interest to our audience And we wanted to bring a camera in, and we wanted to be able to either stream it live on our website or on our television network. But we wanted to capture it in its entirety. And the tribunal said no. So then we went to federal court, and took a long time and a lot of money, but we were successful. So we broadcast that hearing. So since this was going to be the second major tribunal that we were covering, and my first, why don't we live stream it online? Then people can tune in at their leisure. Well, the tribunal wasn't crazy about the idea, because they record it, but only for their own purposes, which is to so they can make transcripts and have a, you know, an accurate record of what was said. But what they did was they had to go to the parties, which are, of course, the survivors, the Canadian Human Rights Commission, and the RCMP, and say, do you have any objections to live streaming? And of course, that set off a whole cavalcade of legal things, not the least of which was a number of survivors did not want their names or likenesses shown on screen. So we've since withdrawn our request. Like, we didn't want to cause survivors any harm or any issues, but we just felt it was of a national interest. But, you know, you have to weigh what it's worth. So in the end, we withdrew our request, but the order, the confidentiality order granted those particular survivors at that time, is still in effect. Like, we would have to go and say, well, we're not live streaming anymore, so can we use their names? And then they would have to agree. And it was, everything was already taking so much time, and this thing had been pushed back so far that we just didn't want to add to that.
Okay. Just kind of going back to last week's hearing, were there highlights of any testimonies that you think are worth reiterating that you likely covered in your coverage as well, but were there moments or highlights in anything that was said in witness testimonies last week that you think bears repeating?
Absolutely. I so many of them, you know, they've had to tell their story, I don't know how many times now, to Laura, starting with Laura Robinson. Then I interviewed them in 2016. Laura interviewed them in 2012. Then RCMP interviewed them numerous times. Then the Canadian Human Rights Commission interviewed them. Of course, in between there, they wrote affidavits and had them sign. Then again, now the Canadian Human Rights Commission did its own investigation before it referred the matter to the tribunal for a hearing. Now again, they are telling their stories. So they've had to tell their stories numerous times. I'm sure they know them by heart, but still, I felt it was powerful. You know, their words carried some weight. Even when I interviewed Dorothy Williams prior to the hearing, the week before, about how she was feeling, I thought, oh, she'll just want to sail through it and, you know, get it done. And she said she was quite nervous, anxious even at telling her story again. And more pressure she felt because three of the survivors have died. There were six in original that filed the complaint to RCMP and then to the Canadian Human Rights Commission. And of those six, three have died. So Dorothy felt extra pressure to tell her story on behalf of her sister, Emma Williams, who died, and as well, and Tom, another survivor who died, and Kathy Woodgate, who was the, you know, lead or representative plaintiff of all of them. Yeah. In the complaint. So she said she knew she had to be their voice. So along with just acknowledging that and paying, you know, tribute to those women, she also talked about, you know, what it was like, how fearful she was of the teacher, AB, who is the inadvertent subject of this hearing, and how when she went for, I think, a year to a different school with white kids, how kind the male teacher was to her. And she was so fearful. She was hiding under a desk, and he extended his hand and said, come out of there. I'm not going to hurt you. And she said, you're not. And she said she had a teacher who didn't hurt her physically and or verbally. And how it, how white kids were nice to her. And she said it changed her whole view of education, and in fact encouraged her to pursue education as a degree. She has a master's degree. She's a very strong educator and has worked as a teacher for many years, and now teaches in Prince George, teaches Indigenous children, and she teaches them the Carrier language and culture, and how this came full circle for her, how she, you know, became a teacher and is saving her ed culture, the language, which was something that was, they worked really hard to get out of her, to drive out of her at this day school. Similarly with Richard Perry, who was on after her, you know, these are all adults now, and how he can neither read nor write. Mm-hmm. We were told numerous times during the hearing how he's illiterate, and yet he can remember what happened to him as a boy. And he talked about, you know, being hit with a strap repeatedly and with this ruler, and how the metal piece drew blood to the point where he would go home and both sides of his hands and his scalp, it had drawn blood there, and he had scars that now are still, were still evident. And lawyers for the RCMP and the Human Rights Commission approached him there and looked at the scars on his head and on his hands, and grew into these scars that he still carries with him today. I found that extremely powerful. He has to live with that reminder, right? Whenever he combs or washes his hair and he feels his scalp, the bumps on there, and when he looks at his hands every day. I just found that very moving. And then, of course, Laura Robinson, the journalist who broke the story, acting on a tip, traveled to Burns Lake from her home in Ontario, didn't know what she was getting into, made numerous trips back, and she's four provinces away. And she's from, you know, Anishinaabe territory. She said she didn't know anything about the Carrier language or customs, and how she found people deep in the bush sometimes, you know, cutting wood, and interviewed them, and their entire lives, no one had ever asked them about what happened to them at day school. They, you see, these survivors were not included in the federal day school settlement agreement, because their school was considered something the diocese built and not mm-hmm. the federal government. And so they don't have any compensation they can apply for. There's no accountability for what happened to them from either the federal government or the Catholic Church. And so no one ever asked them. Laura was the first to approach them and say, what happened to you at Immaculata? And so hearing the story, the genesis of her reporting, she was on the stand for a full 2 days talking about that, how she found people, how she connected with them. These were folks who didn't have cell phones or Wi-Fi or computers. And she found survivors, or they heard of the white lady reporter, they called her, who wanted to know about their time at Immaculata. And then because Kathy Woodgate and Emma Williams trusted Laura, then others decided to trust her too. And how important that trust was in bringing the survivors together as well, because it's not like they sit around and reminisce about Immaculata, good times and bad times. They've never talked about it with each other. Plus, it was difficult for many of these children because their parents were Catholic and did not want to hear any anti-Catholic sentiment or criticism of a priest or a nun or even a teacher at the Catholic school. So they've lived with this for decades, and now they're in their 60s. And now they're, well, when Laura came around, they were in their 50s, but or even younger. That, you know, this has been going on. Laura's been on this story since 2012, so that's 10 years. So hearing the genesis of the story of all the trips Laura made to North Central BC, of the ways she connected with these survivors, and then how she was treated and viewed by the RCMP also stuck out for me.
That's kind of leads in nicely to my next question, which is that, so I was only there on May 2nd. And what I saw was that the RCMP really, or the RCMP lawyers, they didn't seem to be speaking too much or have a lot of follow-ups. But with your coverage over the week, what appeared to be sort of their strategy in defending their previous handling, the RCMP's previous handling of this case?
Yeah, that's, it's interesting. They really heaped a lot of blame on Laura for what they considered contamination of witnesses. I think she handled it quite deftly. The first time she went up there, one of the survivors worked at the band office. So she said, "This is a good place for everybody to come and meet you." So word went out that the white lady reporter was coming to the band office, be here at this time, and she can talk to you at that time. And one of the women even wrote, like, was going to write up on a piece of paper and hang it up and say, come to the band office at this time to meet this person, which is a very common way of communicating in any small community, especially if people don't have phones or Wi-Fi or computers. You write a note or you make a poster. And so the police lawyers made much of that, saying, "Well, did you write the poster?" And she said, "No." "And did you hang it up?" "No." "And did you tell them to put it up?" "No." I mean, these were all this, you come to a community, you let the community do what it does. And then she arrived, and there were more than 30 people waiting there to talk to her. And so the police lawyer said, "Well, they'd been sitting there waiting for you and you were late." And she said, "Well, my train was late," because she took the VIA Rail train from Prince George to Burns Lake, out of her control, right? But then he's alleging that because of that, they had time to sit and compare their stories and collude on them, which Laura said they've had 50 years to collude. Like, well, she didn't use the word collude because that's a cop word, but she just dismissed that as nonsense. I mean, they've never talked about it with each other. And even if they had, I don't think one would adopt another story and say, "Hey, that story of abuse sounds better than mine. I'll use that one." I mean, I'm being facetious, but it's that was what I took from it, was that was the point they were trying to make, that first of all, she's a journalist. She's breaking this story. They just see it as she's walking around in a crime scene and contaminating it. So that to me was interesting to, hear it from their point of view.
Well, Karen Bell has, when she was interviewing Laura for her testimony, asked the question, I think three, if not four times, did you have a vendetta? Was this an act from a vendetta? And it was clear that that had been the sentiment. And by bringing it up and having Laura openly and honestly answer, no, obviously not. I was investigating, this was my, I'm an investigative journalist. I was following the story and speaking to the people
Yes.
who would speak to me in the avenues that I could reach them or speak to them in a place that felt safe for them because of the
Yes.
nature of these affidavits that she later did acquire and witness statements that she got. That to me really stood out as something that had obviously had to be addressed because this was going to be a tactic used by the RCMP lawyers to say that it was maybe to try to make it more personal from Laura's perspective.
That's right, 100%. That was very much the narrative that she even answered the question using their words. "I did not come to Burns Lake and find a bunch of vulnerable people to then manipulate into, colluding or conniving on a complaint, so that could then be filed." I mean, I think she even said that's just nonsense or that's ridiculous. But yeah, that's what you and I.
How is APTN choosing to cover this case, and what are some of the difficulties that you've experienced in covering this case?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, we're committed to covering this story because we did an APTN Investigates documentary on it in 2016. I traveled up to Burns Lake in 2016 and interviewed the six survivors who, they hadn't made the allegations against AB yet, like via the police. But I had read Laura's story. And I mean, these are the kinds of stories we do at APTN. I'd spent 5 years previous to 2016 reporting on residential school survivors and how, you know, there was a class action lawsuit to compensate them under the Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement. But what happened was some lawyers took advantage of survivors, and they were not supposed to pay for any legal services above a certain percentage. But some lawyers seemed to think that didn't apply to them. And I reported on several lawyers, and we named names at the time, who were, you know, we, in our opinion, were ripping off survivors, taking advantage of them and making money off of their pain by overcharging them for the legal services needed to fill in the claim for compensation from the federal government. So, like I say, 5 years covering that, and then there were two lawsuits, class action lawsuits filed on behalf of day school and day scholar survivors. What had happened was the settlement agreement only covered children who went stayed at residential school, which was a boarding school type setup. And it also only applied to, at the time, were called status Indians and Inuit. So Métis and non-status were exempt. So then there was some period in there when the Métis and the non-status were trying to get a class action going, and still haven't succeeded in getting that off the ground. In the meantime, day school stepped up, and that was similar schools. Sometimes they went to classes in a residential school, but then went home at the end of the day. And in fact, what I learned last year was day schools preceded residential schools. The government first said, let's start some schools, get some Indigenous kids in there and get them learning English. And I mean, it wasn't that nice, but you know, their families, a lot of them had to move into these, had to move into towns or villages where the schools were. They were living on a reserve or in the bush. And then they were ordered, you know, to send their children to school or face arrest. So that was done. And many of them did it. Many didn't. Many hid their children. But that's another story for another time. But so residential schools started. But because a lot of kids would like what we call now skip school, I mean, they didn't want to go because of the abuse, or just school was not a good experience for them for a variety of reasons. And the government doubled down and said, well, let's build some residential schools. So that's what happened. So in some communities, the day school is right across the street from a residential school. It was, we've covered residential schools, day schools, 60 scoop, all of these ways that Canada, and the colonial system has tried to assimilate Indigenous peoples in the country and, you know, remove them from their homes, their families, their land, their language, their culture, and, you know, made a mess of it. And now that trauma, as we know, intergenerational trauma, a lot of the healing that they need, they didn't get. We know what the after effects are of what's happened, that disconnection from their roots, the trauma it caused. From the trauma, a lot of them said they've, you know, turned to addiction. It has been a lot of pain and suffering heaped on these folks since school started. And then once the schools were underway, then there was the child welfare system, you know, which we also cover a lot at APTN. So we cover these types of stories because they've caused the most problems, the most issues in Indigenous communities that they're trying to deal with and live with now. And so I often get emails that say, hey, I'm a 60 scoop survivor, I'm a day school survivor, my dad was a residential school survivor, I'm an intergenerational survivor, you know, so it's part of their lexicon, part of the language. And these are stories that are our bread and butter at APTN. So a lot of reporters who I work with, we are We cover these stories regularly. We've learned to become trauma-informed reporters so that we don't do further harm when we're interviewing survivors. And, we understand things like when they say, I have an addiction, we can say, well, did someone in your family go to residential school or day school, or were they part of the 60s scoop? And so right away we have a snapshot at least of who they are and where they came from. But you were asking what some of the difficulties were. Just really quickly, we've battled with the Human Rights Tribunal, we've battled with the RCMP, and we've battled with AB to be able to tell this story without being sued. And it's something that I said at the start, we're committed to stories like this at APTN. We're also committed to our right to tell these stories. Press freedom is very important for us at APTN because we interview vulnerable people like these survivors, and we go into communities where they don't have coverage, and they don't have local newspapers or magazines or TV stations or even radio stations that cover it from a news perspective, a journalism perspective, and we do that. And we've been telling these stories for 20 years. APTN's only 20 years old, but it's become part of mainstream coverage now too, and that's important. So it's just the type of story that we're committed to doing despite all of the barriers that pop up, because we know that the middle of the story, or the beginning of the story, is the survivors, and they are vulnerable people, and they haven't had a voice. And so we help them tell their story.
So the after this kind of 2 week live period, which is happening at the Gathering Place in Burns Lake, will the rest of the next 8 weeks, will those be live streamed on Zoom now, or where did we kind of fall with that?
We will be able, the media, we will be able to view it. I'm going on one of these online things like Zoom or Teams or Skype, but it's not pub for public viewing, which is interesting because these are public hearings. So I don't quite know. We might have to ask about that. But so the witnesses will all be virtual, and we'll be able to watch and listen and report on it. But as far as I know, it's not a link that's open to the public, although I stand to be corrected. So if we find out otherwise, something you and I can both report.
Kathleen, this has been so thoughtful. It's so refreshing to hear someone speak about this that also has so much experience. So, was there anything that I didn't ask that you think is important for people to know as kind of a recap of this first week of coverage by APTN of this human rights hearing?
Yes, on Friday, the lawyer for the Human Rights Commission suggested, well, actually it was Thursday, suggested that they go to the site of the former school, Immaculata. Yeah, it's a church now. And part of the school buildings are no longer there, but there's the room that used to be the gym. And we all heard last week about how the kids were treated in the gym, basketballs thrown at their heads and kicked in the shins and their hair pulled as they were running. So the gym and then the furnace room or the boiler room came up a lot, where Dorothy Williams said, remembers her sister's hands being tied above her head and her being strapped. And Richard Perry said that if you had to be taken to the boiler room, you pretty much made them drag you there. And when asked why the boiler room, he said because it was noisy and it covered up the screams of the children. So the whole tribunal headed over there and met, and there's a hereditary chief who gave the site tour, and he was a student. He's a survivor. He was a student there, and he took them through it, and he made a very emotional speech in the parking lot to everyone about how it wasn't easy for him to go back there and give the tour, but he's still a Catholic today, And he attends church there regularly, and he makes himself do it every Sunday. So, it was a bit of a lesson in resilience, I think, for all of us. He lost a sister. She was 7 years old, and he said she died at the school. And I don't know, he didn't share any details, but that was very impactful. And then he illustrated how it would get very, very cold in the winter. And if you were late, they would lock the door and wouldn't let you in. And you didn't have proper clothing, and you could be outside for 30 minutes or 60 minutes. And, you know, just it was harsh.
Yeah.
From what it sounds like. So he went down the stairs and took everyone with him into the boiler room. And
wow.
And I stood up on top and looked down the staircase, and you could see the pipes and everything that that the survivors had described, and almost hear the screams in your mind, you know, of the children being hurt. I think that was a very powerful way to end the week, and also to, he said to them, he said, "You lawyers," meaning the RCMP and the Human Rights Commission and the tribunal lawyers, "take this back to Ottawa," he said, "and tell the truth." He said, "This is the truth. This is what happened here to us." And, you know, he also said the government shouldn't be let off the hook. He says the Catholic Church gets a lot of heat. But he said, who made the deal with the Catholic Church and the other religions to run the schools, the day and residential schools across Canada? The government built them and funded them. But that was the religious groups that ran them. And he said, who did that? That was the government. So he said, tell Ottawa that we haven't forgotten that. You know, I just think that was a heck of a way to end the week.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate so much you doing the coverage and you leaving and you coming to Burns Lake from Winnipeg. But thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Oh.
Thanks again for tuning in to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at skeenastrong.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks again to our producer, Pam Hassan, and all of our roving reporters. I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.